It's time for Mention and Dispatches here with the Armchair Dragoons as season 7 rumbles on. And tonight, my semi-irregular, quasi-permanent co-host, Mike, is back. BB Mike, how you doing?
I'm doing good. Glad to be back, as always.
This might actually be 2 in a row, because you were here for the catalog episode. So, you know, you're fulfilling your Ed McManley duties quite well.
Depending on how these actually go live, yes.
Yes. We've been consistent about keeping them in order so far. I'm stressing the so far. Our special guest tonight, because we can't go more than 2 straight seasons without bringing her on, Amabel is here from Hollandspiel. Amabel, welcome.
Hello.
Always a pleasure to have you joining us. And so with Amabel here, obviously, we're going to talk a whole lot of Hollandspiel. That said, Mike, I am curious, what's hitting the table next for My Own Worst Enemy?
I believe it's going to be, I did an unboxing on Across Four Aples and Battle Hymns. I think it's going to be Across Four Aples next.
Going Civil War there, huh?
It'll be just a short, what I'm going to try to do is run 2 smaller scenarios in each of those and kind of compare how they play. And, you know, Battle Hymn is supposed to be a follow-up to Across 5 April. So yeah, to kind of do a compare and contrast.
Sounds cool. We'll be looking forward to that on My Own Worst Enemy. And Amabel, we were joking a little bit beforehand that I was going to ask you about, like, what stuff have you played that's not yours? You're saying that you don't get a whole lot of time to play anything that's not yours.
Yeah, because we have, you know, somewhere between usually like 10 and 20 new releases a year, and so much are my designs, so much I do development work on, and it doesn't leave a lot of time for much else. You know, I mean, I log over 1,000 plays every year, but it's almost always Hollandspiel stuff. Occasionally, like in pre-pandemic times, I would play like a Euro-y game with friends. I haven't done that as much. The Euro games in particular aren't as compelling on like TTS for me as they are in person, because mostly I played them in person with people to enjoy their company. You know, it's not that it's a game that I really, oh boy, I really want to play, you know, Catan, but the people who want to play Catan, I'll play it with them. I don't really like want to play a lot of 18XX, but there are people I played with who just want to play 18X. So sure, you know, spend time with them, I'll do that.
Yeah, that makes sense. Yeah, it's, I think for some folks have adjusted really well to the TTS environment, and other folks, as soon as they can put TTS in the rearview mirror, they're happy to get back to regular in-person groups. And there are others that never wanted to get on. I'm saying Tabletop Simulator, right? That is a proxy for any of the available digital mediations, whether it's Tabletopia or Tabletop Simulator or Board Game Arena or Vassal or whatever, like, you know, just
And TTS has been great for playtesting. I've done a lot of playtesting on it and gives me access to a much wider range of playtesters.
Okay.
But, and that's all work, you know. So as far as like playing for fun, I don't remember the last time I played something that wasn't work, you know. That's okay.
Wait, didn't you get into this to be able to have fun with games?
I mean, it is fun. It is fun. The work is fun, but it's still work. It's not the kind of thing you hear people say, oh, don't make your hobby into your job, because then you'll hate your hobby. I don't hate it. I you know, I love the work and I love what I'm doing. I just recognize it as work, and I mean, it's fun work, and I'm very lucky that, you know, that's my job, is to sit down and roll some dice. But you know, I don't necessarily do it to unwind as much the way most people would play games.
Totally understand that. We've mentioned on some podcasts in the past with you that I do think it's really cool that for a company that thrives on niche games, that you've been able to turn Hollandspiel into a full-time job, into a viable, legitimate, consistent full-time occupation for you, which, I mean, there can't be more than 20 people who are making a full-time living off of the hobby war game segment of the market. And you found a way to be one of them. And I think that's really cool. It's a testament to some of the neat stuff you guys do. Some of it is the business model you've been able to set up with that print on demand model, has, I'm sure that has certainly made a big difference for you. Because we've talked about it before and you've admitted it. So
yeah, no, it makes a huge
I'm not
difference.
Speculating here. You've told us that.
Yeah, no, it makes a huge difference. And we also, we lean into what that model does well and lets us do well. You know, I think if we were publishing just kind of quote unquote normal, run-of-the-mill, supposedly broadly appealing games with this model, I don't think we'd do as well at all.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah, and I think similar to that, although you'd never explicitly stated this that I recall, but I think similar to that, if you were sort of stuck on that Kickstarter pre-order crowdfunding treadmill, that it would probably be a very different lineup of games, and I suspect probably less satisfying to you.
Oh, absolutely.
To play with.
Yeah, absolutely. And it'd also be just, you know, I think just a lot fewer number of games, which would make it less likely to be viable as like a full-time thing. And I think really, frankly, because, you know, we looked briefly at, hey, should we do Kickstarter when we were starting up the company? We looked at different ways we're going to fund things. And, you know, we very quickly realized we do not really have the skill set to run a campaign on Kickstarter. It's a very particular skill set. It's different than the skill set to just publish games or design games. So this lets us play to our strength. Now, if we did Kickstarter now, we probably would fund because we have that reputation. We're not interested in doing it.
Well, you got a built-in audience. You know, I mean, it's been a good number of years now that you've built that audience, and you've to throw a bad analogy out there, you've done it as an indie rock band, right? You put out consistent hits that appeal to the audience. And you've hit that audience over and over and over, and you've built a pretty solid hardcore following that each year, every one of them brings another friend into the crew, and that audience has grown not through gimmickry, right? It's been actual work, and that's cool. You know, I mean, that you guys have gotten there.
Yeah, we this will be, so we've just started our sixth year in business. We've done okay.
Yeah. And now that we've just had the big Hollenspiel Love Fest, Mike, ask something challenging so that I don't just sound like I'm kissing up to the guests.
Ask something challenging. When is Horse and Musket 5 coming out? No.
So that should be sometime next year. We're hoping for earlier in the year, because, you know, we had a release schedule where we'd have at the end of each year would have a new box volume, the beginning of each year would have a new annual, and then 2020 happened, and so we ended up not releasing a box game in 2020 for Horse and Musket. It got pushed till August of this year, and then September, and then we at least the annual like a month later. So we'd like to get kind of close to back on our schedule. So right now we're looking for entries for the fourth annual while Sean and Doug are working on the development of, you know, finishing up polishing the fifth volume of the box series. So of the six main volumes. And of course, we already have a prequel volume that's come out. We have another prequel volume that's scheduled probably between the fifth and sixth. It might come after the sixth. It depends on, you know, how it shakes out. But that'll be a prequel volume that Doug Miller is actually designing on the Italian Wars.
So he's designing it. He's not just developing.
Yeah.
Oh, that's
that particular volume.
That's really, you
know,
cool.
Because other than Sean, no one knows the series better than Doug. Yeah. You know. So.
Yeah. You mentioned 2020 happened. I something popped up in my social media memories yesterday that still makes me chuckle. They were talking to kids about 2020, and some 9-year-old had said it's like looking both ways before crossing the street and getting hit by a submarine.
That's a good way to put it.
That's like the most accurate description of 2020 anybody ever came up with.
Yeah, 2020 was great a year. It turned out okay for me in the end.
So back up onto Horse and Musket here just a little bit. This has been a long-running series for you guys. And, you know, you said the one box game a year plus the annuals. This has been going for a while because we're up to, you know, five boxed volumes at this point. Take us back to looking back at the start of the Horse and Musket series to where we are now. What are some of the biggest changes in that evolution from volume one to now, But what are some of the things that have been really consistent about it also? And what are some of the things that really clicked and have stayed in place as the series has grown?
So I think that something that's been consistent is that it's the foundation of the system, and the idea of the system is this kind of very adaptable sandbox you can play around in to recreate any of these battles from the period, even like really obscure things. That's been, you know, at the core of it all along. And the series has kind of grown over time, where we have the annuals, which have multiple designers, like fans come in, design scenarios. Mm-hmm. So it's become bigger than what we thought it was going to be originally. I think some things that have changed, to begin with, if you buy Volume 1 now, it is a different creature than what Volume 1 was when it came out in 2017. The box is bigger. The counters look a bit different. The rule book has been rewritten and is clear. Basically, and the player aid is different. I mean, every piece of paper or cardboard in there has been changed to make the game more accessible. Because it was a game that we released very early on. It was our 12th release. It came out like the spring of 2017. So we hadn't even been in business for a full year yet at that time. It was the biggest game that we had attempted. And there were some spots that were a bit rough. And, you know, that I'm going to take the blame for that, because I was not as well versed in the period as I should have been in order to serve as an adequate developer.
Yeah. Okay.
Which is one reason why we brought Doug Miller on as developer, because he knows the period and can answer people's questions and can talk with Sean about, hey, this element maybe needs some finessing, or this works really well. And that's something that we kind of brought on, which we weren't expecting to ever bring on an outside developer on anything, because we're cheap. I mean, big part of why the model works is that we don't have overhead other than art costs. And most of the, you know, other than the map art, I mean, these days, I mean, I do the counters, I do the box art, I do the, Mary or I do the player aids, all that stuff is done in-house. And, you know, we don't pay ourselves to do that.
Directly. You're still paying yourself because you got to finish it out.
But
you're not paying yourself the going rate for an artist.
Yeah, exactly. So bringing on like a developer was something that, you know, we weren't anticipating doing, but, you know, we found the series was big enough that I could not handle it. Partially because also, I mean, it has 20 scenarios in the box, right? And with like two releases coming out a year, that's 40 scenarios that need to be gone through and tested and checked. And it just would create this bottleneck where nothing else would get done while we were working on Horse and Musket. And we're trying to remove that bottleneck, and we've done pretty good about that. Yeah. So that's kind of, I had a train of thought there. So eventually we kind of, especially once the pandemic happened, realized, hey, there are some things that make the game harder to teach, to learn than it should be, less accessible than it should be. And we have this break now because of the pandemic where let's reassess how everything's presented. And let's try another approach to see if we make it more accessible, especially as, you know, with the volumes that are coming. Volume 4, which just came out, Volume 5, and Volume 6. These are the battles people really care about. Because the series starts with, like, the War of the Grand Alliance and Marlboro and Eugene. And the second volume is kind of an in-between that. And the third volume, which is the Seven Years' War. But then Volume 4... you have the American and French Revolutions. Yep. Volume 5, you have the Napoleonic period. Volume 6, you have the Crimean War, the ACW, everything from, you know, the end of Napoleon till the 1860s. And those are topics that are perennials.
Yeah.
So those are going to bring in a lot more people who maybe weren't as interested in the Seven Years' War or the War of the Austrian Succession or the War of the Polish Succession or any of those successive wars of succession. So, we really wanted to be as accessible as possible. And that's why we redid the player aids, redid the setup diagrams, kind of reapproached everything from scratch, which was a pain in the neck. Because I laid out those counters. 1,100 counters I had to redo, you know, step back and front.
Is your friend at that point.
Yeah.
A couple of notes here. First of all, like, people at home can't see, but it was kind of fun when you had to look up what which hex it was that you released. And you just sort of turn and look at the bookshelf behind your head. That's
Well, because...
Hey, you look, know, product placement.
at the end of this year, we're releasing number 64.
Yep.
I cannot remember what number is what.
Oh, I know. But I just think it's great that you had it perfectly positioned behind your head to just sort of rotate and look it up. For folks that are curious about Doug as the developer, like, we've got the previous podcast with Amabel and Doug linked to this episode. So once you're done listening to this, or if you want to pause this one and go listen to that one, that's fine. But we've got an extended Horse and Musket one right below this on the podcast post. So you can always catch up with Doug's thoughts and the perspective he brings to all of this through that podcast. And Doug's a pretty smart dude. So hearing his thoughts about it is always a good thing, yeah. Always entertaining. I think it's cool too, that just the print on demand model, the ability to, hey, we've updated the rule book to include some clarifications and better wording of things, and poof, suddenly all of the previous editions of the game have that same updated rule book in them. So that's a handy thing with the print on demand model, isn't it?
Yeah. So, I mean, Doug's done great work as developer for Horse and Musket. He's also been really great helping me with table battles, because especially the last expansion that we did was the Grand Alliance, and then the next expansion is Great Battles of Charles Alexander of Lorraine. And he's let me pick his brain. He has such a vast library. It's been very helpful to me as someone who is more of a dilettante, you know, for that period of history.
Mike, you're the Horse and Musket guy here. Why am I doing all the talking? Jump in here, man.
Well, I've asked my one question now. Just kidding. Actually, I do. I did receive a Horse and Musket Volume 4, and that's going to get to the tabletop at some point, because we're getting now into the time period that I really like. And it's interesting, though, because, and this is the thing about the Horse and Musket series, I think, in general. It's, you know, years before I heard of Horse and Musket, if you'd asked me if I wanted to play something like the Battle of Killiecrankie, I would look at you like you were crazy. I'm like, what? Play what? But, you know, you play it, and it's the rules are easy to learn, and it's such a fun system to play that I think if you buy one of these, you know, any of the time period you're interested in, I think you're going to have a good time with it.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. And I agree.
it is. It's a rules rule. I won't say rules light. I guess it kind of is, though. But it's the rule. The rule books are well written. It's easy to understand, and you know, you have the option to add in the optional rules as you get a little more advanced. Which I know they're called optional rules, but a lot of those rules are almost mandatory when you play it, in my opinion. But
I'm one who. I basically just play with the base rules. I don't even use the formation rules or the facing rules. I know most people do incorporate those, but you know, I don't like facing rules in games. I just dislike them. So,
but that's the beauty of those. You get, you know, if you want to use them, great. If you don't, that's okay too.
As Armchair Dragoons continue the seventh season of Mentioned in Dispatches, we need to take a moment to thank those Patreon supporters who pledged at the regimental patron level. So a special thank you to Patrick Mullen, Hethwill Wargames, Steelgrave, Mike Quigley, Staggerwing, Robert, Joseph Knoll, Treb Curry, Kevin Bertram, and Patrick Garrity for their support of Armchair Dragoons and helping us bring you the best wargaming content on the web. You can join our Patreon supporters at patreon.com/armchairdragoons.
To shift topics here off of Horse and Musket a little bit.
No, wait. No.
Dude, I gave you a chance.
Yeah, I know. We'll come back to. Go ahead.
I was going to get to your other favorite topic, and that is some of the solo games.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. So you guys have a line of, I don't want to say they're necessarily a series. They all sort of share some rules underpinnings. Stilicho and Aurelian, you've got a couple of these different ones that not, I guess it's kind of the same family, maybe not even the same family, same group hug worth of solo games
so
here.
So there are a couple different kind of series of solo games we have. Yeah. There are two games by Robert Dalesky that are Wars of Marcus Aurelius and Stilicho Last of the Romans. Those are kind of card-driven solo games. People compare them to the States of Siege games, but I like these games. I don't like States of Siege, so I don't like that comparison. And then there is...
It's their comparison.
Yeah. And then there is a separate series of games that were my designs, which are Agricola, Master of Britain, Charlemagne, Master of Europe, and Aurelian, Restorer of the World, which are based on a chit cup system, where the chits in the cup represent how various groups feel about your governance. So there's a friendly, unfriendly, and hostile cup, and the actions you take will shift public opinion from one cup to the other. You don't know quite what chit is being shifted. You just know that generally you're making some people vaguely unhappy, a little vaguely happy. You don't really know who's with you or against you until you pull the thing out of the cup. And that's been pretty popular. And then two other solo games we have are Escape from Hades from Fred Manzo. And it's a science fiction game. Yep. And then NATO Air Commander by Brad Smith.
Yeah.
And that's, yeah, those are our solo games so far. We should have a couple more solo games out next year.
So you mentioned the Dalesky ones in particular. And you got to the States of Siege comparison before I could. So I'll blame it on you. But you mentioned, you know, you like those a lot more than you like the States of Siege games. For the audience that may not know a ton about the difference between them, what is there one sort of key thing that you can kind of put your finger on that says this is the big difference between them? Or are there a couple of little ones that really make the difference there?
I can do it in one word. Because the Dalesky games have agency. So that's, you have decisions to make. That's the one, you know, what you do actually matters in the game. so no, that's why I like them. You know, you actually have ways to mitigate, the randomness of the dime rolls. You have, a variety of actions available to you. Now there are some States of Siege games that would do that. Like Cruel Necessity, I think, was a States of Siege game I actually enjoyed. For the most part, I wasn't a fan.
I've heard those comparisons before, and so I was sort of curious from your perspective. I didn't know how you had felt about the States of Siege games before I asked the question, but I did want to ask sort of what's the comparison there between them and where do you see some of those differences? Just to confirm for the audience, these games are not linkable. It's not like you can lay all three maps out next to each other or the Dalesky games.
They're similar
engine underneath them, but they are not linkable games the way some of the States of Siege games might be linkable.
No.
So, yeah. Okay. Just wanted to, I didn't think so. I wanted to make sure that was crystal clear for the audience hearing it there. So, you know, again, leaving aside the one-offs of NATO Air Commander and the Escape from Hades, is there any thought of coming back? Of going back to Dalesky and getting another, is there one in development that we're breaking news on here that Dalesky's got another one coming or that you've got another one coming in your series?
Well, we would love to work with Robert again with another solo game. I know right now he's doing a two-player war game for Capstone Games, which that's very exciting because they're not usually a war games publisher. But yes, we'd love to work with him again. I do have a solo game in that kind of semi-series I have that I'm working on, but this one is about the Shackleton expedition.
Oh, cool. Okay.
So it's how these men feel about your leadership as they're, you know, trying to survive Antarctica.
It's an interesting engine. Let's, you know, Agricola, Aurelian, and the Antarctic expedition. All right.
Yeah. I mean, and I say cool because I just watched, there's a movie on that I just watched. I don't know how the movie is. It was on DVD, but yeah, it was a interesting movie, interesting story behind that expedition. So that's something to look forward to.
Yep. I'm just trying to, there are a couple problems that I'm you know, working on. I'll get them eventually. I'm working on this one for a while. I'll eventually, for a long while, actually, because Aurelian came out in 2020, but the design for that was finished in early 2018. We just were waiting on the art, because that was the last game that Anya Ziakowska did art for. I've been working on Shackleton off and on since then, still working on it. I will get it eventually. I usually do. So hopefully next year, maybe the year after. You know, I'll figure it out.
Grass Crown recently came out, and there were already complaints about the artwork.
There were complaints about the artwork? Oh, about the map.
Yes.
It was too green.
But it's a boring map. It's a green field. What do you want to do with the map?
Right. Yeah, no, it's going to be a green field because it's not, we're not fighting like the battle of the balls where you have all this terrain, you know?
Yeah. It was a giant empty green field. You know, I mean, that's sort of where it happens.
Yeah.
Talk to us some, though, about the Shields and Swords series.
Sure.
Where some of this came from. Again, it's a series. It's evolved over time. Sort of how have we gotten to where we are now?
So Shields and Swords started as a series of medieval games. And like some of my very earliest design work, like back in, I don't know, 2011, 2012. First one didn't come out until a few years after that. Actually had been signed with Victory Point. And then Victory Point put it in their pipeline and it, you know, never came out. So it came out somewhere else.
Because Victory Point quit coming out.
Well, yeah, there was that too. The Shields and Swords medieval series has been fairly popular, and I wanted to do an ancients line. So a couple years ago, we did With It or On It, which is a Greek hoplite battles, which is kind of took it in a very different direction because the core medieval games, they all had a common rule set. The rule set was designed to cover all these battles. Whereas once I started working on the ancients game, I originally was looking at like, well, can I do a core rule set? And no, the period of history and the way battles are fought is so very different that each game is going to need its own rule set. So with Ironic, I had its own rule set. And then the Grass Crown had its own rule set, that builds on that, but it is substantially different. And so, yeah, With It or On It covers hoplite battles. There are six of them. The Grass Crown covers 10 Roman battles. And while the six hoplite battles, they're all, you know, different, you know, they're kind of fought in the same way because that style of warfare was not really evolving at that time. Whereas with the Grass Crown, the period covered is about 250 years of the Roman Republic. So you're seeing the evolution from the Manipular Legion to the Marian Legions and the integration of different tactics and methods and training of troops and so on. So over the course of the 10 scenarios, you will kind of get a feel for how these things evolved and how they adapted to the various challenges posed by Greek armies, Carthaginian armies, the Gauls, all that fun stuff. So that's kind of how that's evolved. I'm really proud of the Grass Crown. It is the first game, first box to have my new name on it, which I appreciate. And put a lot of work into it. The rule book has like over 40 diagrams to help you learn the game, because something people said about With It or On It is that they found it a little obtuse, a little difficult to wrap their head around because there are some kind of new concepts in it. And so I tried to explain them a bit better with the illustrations in the Grass Crown. Grass Crown also has a history booklet that runs about 28 pages, which has 104 footnotes and various jokes about the Roman Republic. So it's idiosyncratic, and it seems to have been very well received. And I'm really happy about that.
For folks that may not be as familiar with the Shield and Swords series, what is sort of the core mechanic that is a player I'm manipulating as a piece? Well, I mean, obviously, like the name sort of tells you this is Shields and Swords. You have to walk up next to somebody and hit them over the head. Got all that. But is this how much maneuver is there? How much leadership morale plays into things? How much of this is sort of mustering forces to the right place at the right time? How much of it is getting people into the right formation? What is it that's kind of the core shtick that I, as a player, am manipulating when I'm pushing counters around?
So the core shtick is that there are, depending on if it's the medieval or the ancients variation, there are between 4 and 6 phases in a turn, but you're only going to perform two phases, because you're going to have these double-sided command markers, and you're going to play them in some combination to determine what phases you're going to have on your turn. So in the medieval series, for example, the move and shield wall are on the same side of a command token, and it's been a while since I played the medieval ones. Hang on. Combat You can't do move and shield wall in the same... Oh, it's combat and withdraw. So you can't do a combat and a withdraw at the same time because they're on the same chit, right? So you either play a move in a combat or a shield wall in a combat, or you combine them in whatever way you want. So you perform those phases on your turn. The units are divided into color-coded wings, which lets you check for things like the integrity of the wing. This carries over especially in the ancient series, because when a unit is eliminated in the ancient series, you do a route check for all the units in your line, and if they're not in the proper formation, then they too will be eliminated. So the whole, you know, chunk of the line can collapse at once dramatically if you put the pressure at the right place, which is meant to replicate the way things will happen in ancient battle. You have this line that's sturdy, and you get these little cracks in the line, and then it breaks and it's catastrophe. So the game is built around creating those moments of catastrophe.
Make a mess out of things.
Yeah.
And so as this series has shifted to the ancient world, how much, if at all, has that core shtick sort of evolved or been forced to evolve based on the changes in warfare between the medieval era? And look, the casual historian is going to look at that and go, oh, you got a shield, you got a sword, you walk over and stick the pointy end in the other guy. Like, obviously, there's some differences in the way warfare was fought.
Yeah, so one of the ways that core shtick has changed is just the way the command markers, the commands on the markers are paired. So in the ancient series, the move and the combat are going to be on the same marker. So you cannot move and fight in the same turn. This creates kind of a more of a maneuver stage in the first several turns of the game where you're trying to get into the right position. And then once the lines are in collision, they're not going to move much because they're just pushing at each other. Except for, you know, when they have a moment where they can move. And it's definitely built more around the integrity of a formation. Because the cool thing about the Ancients one is if you have a counter that takes a hit,
mm-hmm.
that counter might be flipped, or you can flip a counter that's adjacent to it, one that's behind it.
Off the hit.
Yeah, and so in this way, the 10 or 12 counters in the wing really all function as parts of a whole, as like a The core maneuver unit, fighting unit, is actually the wing of 10 or 12 pieces of cardboard. And so this allows, you know, the wing gets weaker and weaker, and you're trying to rally and flip it back. And then some of the counters in the line, instead of just having one stripe on the reverse side, which is, you know, the reduced side, they have two stripes. Those are brittle units. They get eliminated right away when they get flipped, which prompts that route check, which might cause things to break unexpectedly. And you don't know where your brittle units are. You know how many you have, but you don't know where they are in your wing. So everything's kind of built around that moment, and that's definitely a refocus from what the series was in the medieval line. That wasn't really what we were paying attention to as much. And part of that is has to do with differences in the way battles are fought between the ancient and medieval eras, and part of it is just my evolution as a designer, because those medieval games, again, those are things that the core systems that I came up with in 2011, 2012, and all those designs just been kind of iterating on that, whereas the ancients thing is me now approaching it as a more mature designer, someone who has, you know, 50 plus games under her belt.
Yeah, I... You would hope that with a whole lot more designs that you've gotten better as a designer. And
yeah,
if not, that would be problematic. So
that's, yeah.
So it's interesting that even in that ancient game that there is some friendly fog of war, that when you're trying to create those moments of catastrophe for your opponent, it's not just a when, but also a where those moments of catastrophe might happen. You have no idea. And even you as the friendly commander have no idea that someone that appears strong may not in fact be that strong. They may be a brittle unit, as you said.
Yeah.
So that's kind of cool. I think that, that gives folks a good sense of sort of what to expect there.
Another question I might have is another recent acquisition of mine was Empire at Sunrise. And usually when I get a new game, I'll go look on Tabletop Simulator to see if there's a mod there for it. And I was just curious. I know when I looked for that, I did find one. In fact, there's a couple of mods on Tabletop Simulator for Holland Spiel Games. Do you support those on Tabletop Simulator? What are your thoughts on taking a game and putting it into Tabletop Simulator? Or is that something you'd rather not see? Or
yeah, so we're happy to have that done. What generally happens is someone will ask us, hey, can I do a TTS mod or a Vassal mod? And we'll say, okay, sure. Don't put the rule book in there.
Yeah.
We don't want to see the rule book in there. But other than that, yeah. And we'll give them files which they can use to make the mod. And, you know, I will, you know, have them send me the mod before it goes live so I can poke around and make sure it's an accurate reflection of the game.
Okay. Well, it's interesting to know. And it's interesting that you do send the files upon request. I know that with Horse and Musket, I think I ended up doing those things manually myself. But that's interesting.
You should have asked us.
Yeah, I'm kind of realizing that now. And actually, now that I'm thinking about it, maybe I'll shoot you an email and see if we can get that thing uploaded to Tabletop Simulator. Because I'll make some stuff like that all the time for myself. And of course, I'm not going to upload it without, you know, the publisher's permission. So yeah, that's good to know.
It's more fun to make Mike work for things.
Sometimes. Well, you know, you learn a lot when you take one of these games and put it into Tabletop Simulator. So that's cool. That's cool.
Mike mentioned one of the games that's come in from an outside designer. Obviously, there's you're the main designer for Hollandspiel.
Less than half the games are mine, but I do have more than other designers. So I guess so.
The plurality of games, I guess, would be yours. But when folks are pitching games to you, what are some of the key things that you're looking for to say, yeah, that's a good Hollandspiel game, or guys, that's not quite right for us, we're going to take a pass on it?
You know, every time I've been asked this question before, and every time I ask this question, I have like different answers. And what I've really come to realize is that the really true answer is we got to have a feeling about it.
Yeah.
You know, like we've gotten games that, you know, on paper tick off all the boxes. And there's been times when we've actually said, okay, I mean, this really seems like it fits. Let's go ahead and do this. And, you know, it's a good game. We were excited about it in that sense, but weren't necessarily feeling it, you know? And those games don't do as well as we would expect. So we've come to kind of trust our gut as far as, you know, do we have this gut feeling? We're super excited about this game. And I can't itemize what makes us super excited about a game, because there are games that should appeal to us that don't, and games that shouldn't but do, you know. Like we have a Mark Herman game, Ribbit, which is like an abstract game and really kind of a family game you can play with kids. And it doesn't really seem to tick off our boxes for, you know, for what we have in our line, but we just were really excited about it, really jazzed about it. So we wanted to get it out there, you know. And I would say it's just really, you've got to have that gut feeling that this is something that we want out in the world and that we can put out in the world. Because there are games we get excited about where, because of the component cost that would be involved, just doesn't make sense for our business model. Yeah. Unfortunately, we end up having to pass on those.
Yeah. You mentioned the having a feel for it. I think we had talked about this on a previous podcast of sort of what makes a good Hollandspiel game. But one of the reasons I kind of wanted to ask is you had mentioned before something very similar to sort of the feel for it. And I guess part of this is sort of that feeling can evolve over time also too, mm-hmm. can't it? Like the things that got you jazzed about stuff in 2016 may not be the same things now. They may be, I've seen it before, don't want to do it again. Or, wow, that's really innovative. I've learned more about how these things work. I want to try it this time where I might have passed on it 5 years ago.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah. So, people evolve, companies evolve. So,
yeah, people definitely evolve.
There are a handful of designers that you've worked with multiple times out there. You know, Dolesky, one of them. Yourself, obviously, you've worked with yourself a couple of times. But there are a handful that you've worked with multiple times. How much have there been times where you've called them up and said, "Hey, really enjoyed working on this game. What else do you have?"
Is there a
great success story there you'd want to share with the crowd of?
I'll tell you, John Gurkowski, who did Empire at Sunrise for us, I think actually every time we published one of his games through Howl & Spiel, it started with us reaching out to him, because we had worked with him with a different publisher and enjoyed the process of working with him. So when we started our own company, we asked him, you know, could you do a game on this topic? And he did a Plan 1919, which turned out okay. And then a little while later, he said, you know, what are some topics I want to do a game on us for, a game for us on? And that was The Lost Provinces, which was about the Franco-Thai War. And that was really successful. And then we said, hey, you know, can you do something about Japan and World War One? World War One is kind of his wheelhouse. And that was Empire of Sunrise, which has been a very successful game. We've really had that benefit. Brian Train, a lot of the time, now he had designs, you know, already like in the hamper, but would ask him, you know, what do you have anything for us? You know, we'd like to work with you again. Did the District Commander series, which we just published the fourth volume earlier this year. That started because we asked him, hey, what is your nerdiest, least commercial thing? We'll publish it. And then he gave us District Commander. And people seem to enjoy it. So
was that only because Tupamaro had already been published by somebody else? Because Tupamaro is a pretty nerdy Brian Train design.
I think District Commander series is, and I don't mean nerdy in a bad way, but it's less flashy than some other games might be, you know. And I had a hoot working on that, because that's the first one I did the counter illustrations for. That's why I bought the Wacom tablet to, you know, draw the counter stuff myself, because I don't have to pay someone to do it. And Brian, of course, comes up with some of the most unusual counters that you need for a game. I got to do some caricatures of celebrities. I got to do animals. I mean, I got to do all sorts of things for that series, and kept me on my toes.
I don't think it's in any of the games anywhere, but I do recall a very serious conversation going on back when I was working at a defense contractor about the appropriate map symbol for a donkey-borne IED. Everybody knew what a vehicle-borne IED was supposed to be like. They had adapted the UAV IED for, you know, like strap a hand grenade to a remote control airplane and fly it into something. But they were arguing over what the appropriate map symbol was supposed to be for the donkey-borne IED. And this was a very real, very serious conversation that went on for some amount of time until finally the voice of reason broke in and said, you know, if there's not a published standard, do whatever the bleep you want, because nobody can tell you you're wrong. So, yeah, if somebody says that's not the right symbol, you challenge them to show you the correct symbol. And when they can't, you've won your argument. Move on. Yeah. So there's one for you to work on at some point with the tablet, right? What would you come up with for a donkey-borne IED? You know, so.
I don't know. I'd be afraid about the donkey getting hurt, so.
Mike, what else you got here?
Well, I told you I was going to listen a lot. I'm trying to learn. It just popped into my head because I was reading in the forums. We actually had started a thread on the Horse and Musket series, but this is kind of more generic. And someone brought up the fact that, I guess, Howl & Spiel does not have any across the seas or overseas distribution. Is that something that you've looked at, or are you just, you're not interested in? Our next question.
Okay. So when we started the company, we were shipping to Europe directly, and we lost money every year doing that because things would get lost in the post, they'd be reshipped, things would bounce back. People would be surprised that there were customs charges on things from other countries and refuse to pay them and then get upset they didn't get their games. You know,
it got to the point where customs charges are such a new and recent invention that, you know, where did those come from?
And we were reaching out to different retailers in Europe And we couldn't find people who would work with us. Basically because our print on demand model gives us a very slender profit margin. Yeah. So, and it costs money, of course, to get it from our side of the ocean to their side of the ocean. And so either we'd need to sell it to them at a loss, or they'd need to sell it at a loss to their customers, or they need to sell it at an upcharge. Now, we did get a retailer that's based in the UK, the Second Chance Games, and they ship all our games to Europe as well. So we stopped shipping to Europe and the UK at all, except through Second Chance Games. Now, some people in Europe obviously aren't happy about that, especially with Brexit. I understand that. We have talked to some EU-based, you know, continental retailers since then. But again, he's hit the brick wall of they don't want to take on our, you know, accept our terms. And if they don't accept our terms, we are selling them at a loss. So, you know, that becomes the problem. And we actually have had two retailers in the EU who would accept our terms. They didn't work out for two different reasons. One of them was trying to get us to do something shady. And we're not gonna work with you if you're no. That's just not how that works. And then the other, this was fun. The other what referred to me by a previous name. And I said, "Hey, that's not my name anymore." They're like, "Yeah, I know. I'm still just gonna call you this." And that's that. You know, if you wanna to become a business partner with. Want to become a business partner with a trans woman? Maybe don't misgender her. I don't know that this. I mean, maybe it seems like common sense to me, but it was not for them. So
yeah, I can see that certainly rankling.
And here's the thing: we have the luxury of only working with people that we want to work with.
Yeah,
yeah.
You know, and I mean, I know it sucks for some people in the EU, though. Granted. If we had an EU-based retailer on the continent, probably the prices would be about the same they are for Second Chance. Because Second Chance is not making a lot of money on those at all.
Yeah.
But they are paying for them to get across the ocean and paying those customs fees to get them into the UK in the first place.
It sounds like the appropriate course of action here is to simply call the boys at Blue Panther and have them set up a satellite operation in Europe somewhere.
Okay, so actually we looked into
Europe and then ship from there.
So we looked into that as well. And we looked into different printers in Europe to see if we have a Europe-based production center. And, you know, there'd be issues with that, obviously, because we would not have as much insight into quality control, which is very important to us because it's our company. It's our name. It's our reputation. But we couldn't find anywhere in Europe that would print it and allow us to price it to make a profit. Like the couple places we found what they were going to charge to print the games, if we sold them at the MSRP we sell them in for the US, we would have been selling them at a loss for the production cost.
Wow.
Because again, we're printing on demand. If we were doing offset printing, you know, getting 1,000, 2,000, 3,000 copies, it'd be a whole different story.
Yeah.
Because those would be much cheaper. But then we'd be in a traditional distribution network anyway.
Yeah. Just building on that whole print-on-demand model, I think, you know, there's probably somebody listening to this that says, you've got to hit with Table Battles. You've got to hit with Horse and Musket. You've got to hit with fill-in-the-blank game. Why wouldn't you just go ahead and crank out 500 of those and you know, go ahead and sell those through that model? But the problem is, that print-on-demand model allows direct point-to-point shipping as well, that Brant orders game, Brant receives game, not, you know, Hollenspiel prints 500, now has to ship through distributors to stores to wherever. Like, that's a whole... I learned a lot of this the hard way from my brief foray into being a publisher, and I was bad at it, which is why I don't do it anymore. So, you know, the idea of... Had your business model existed when I was trying to do things 15 years before you were, I might have, you know, stumbled my way through this a little longer, but that entire distribution model for regular retail production is such a completely different animal than what you guys do, that would really upend a lot of things. Just based on my limited experience in the business, I think that would so dramatically change what you do. And obviously you've investigated this, you know, I'm not telling you, you don't know. I mean, there might be two people in the audience that haven't figured this out yet, you know? So,
And you know, the thing that's great though, also is the model lists us published with impunity. We just kind of do what we want.
Yeah.
And make a living at it. So like I really don't need to worry about like, is this profitable? Is there a market for this? There probably will be. I mean, even if something flops, we make a profit.
Yeah.
We don't have flops really, but if we did, it would still make a profit. Actually, just do it just because I wanted to. So, yeah. You know,
I mean, a profit for a Happy Meal, but it's a profit.
Yeah. So I'm not. So we're not interested in changing that at all because, you know, we just, I mean, it's ideal, really.
Yeah.
You know, it's heaven.
So I did point out in that thread, though, that, you know, you can get the PDFs of these things over at like Wargame Vault. So it's all there. You can do the, you know, your own print and play. It's not, maybe not the most elegant solution, but, you know, it is there.
Yeah, we're a little bit behind on those, but we're trying to get caught up. So yeah. Hopefully we'll get caught up soon.
And the cool thing about those is I learned, like I said earlier, is you can take those and buy those PDFs. And that's how you get them in a tabletop simulator when you don't know that you can ask for the art files.
Well, you know, the way we look at it, someone's put it on Tabletop Simulator or Vassal, they're doing us a favor, you know, because we're not paying them for that. It's all a volunteer thing. The least we can do is give them the files, you know, and they're gonna put that. I put together a Vassal mod before. It was bad. I was bad at it, but I know how much work's involved in that in TTS, and just like, yeah, no, you if you want to do that, we'll give you the files. I mean, thank you for doing it. Helps more people play the game and learn the game, be exposed to the game.
Definitely, yeah.
Yeah. So now that we just talked about the fact that you guys tend to go point to point on all of your distribution, I will say there's Hollenspiel stuff on the rack in my local store because Gamers Armory here in Cary is my local game store. How many retail outlets out there do you guys actually have stuff on the shelves in? It can't be just Gamers Armory. I'm sure there is at least one more somewhere.
So there's Gamers Armory. There's Board Game Bliss in Canada. And there is Second Chance Games in the UK. We did have some going through a shop in Japan for a while. It's been a while since we had an order from them, though. And there was a store in Austin that bought some of our stuff early on. I guess they didn't sell theirs because they were very unhappy with having made that decision. But that was very early in our, we had like four or five games out at that point. So, you know, we didn't really have that reputation going yet. So, I mean,
so this is, we're talking single digits numbers of,
oh yeah,
of stores out there.
Yeah. So. And we don't mind selling to the retailers, of course, but you know, the crux of our, and we don't really sell to online retailers. Like we have some online retailers that offered to buy, they're US based that offered to buy from us, and it's like they can just buy it from our store. We'd rather they do that. Yeah. So we're not going to do that. It doesn't make sense for our model.
Yeah, that one seems counterintuitive. You know, I can see getting it into a brick and mortar store where somebody can see it on the rack and that sort of serendipitous discovery of, oh hey, what's this? You know, that would make sense. But I could totally see not bothering to compete with yourself for web sales.
Yeah. But
that would seem silly. So a question for you on some of the other game designs that you've brought in. You know, you talked some about things that are kind of feel, but that again, even the flops you don't lose money on. Is there something you brought in that you were sort of, you know, I'm not really sure what kind of market there's going to be for this, but then it turned out that holy crap, there is, and it's bigger than you thought. And like, what was something that was a bit of an unexpected success for you guys?
I mean, for me, probably it was one of my own designs. That was Table Battles. Yeah. I did not expect that to resonate with people the way it did. I mean, it is our best-selling game, hands down. And that's just a core game. I think I'm talking about the expansions on top of it. And like, I did not think people would be that into it. And really, the reason why that game exists at all is because of Richard Berg, because we published a game of his called Dynasty, and he had, we needed some wooden sticks as a component, and we were ordering wooden sticks from a supplier in Germany, and in order to get better pricing, we needed to order more sticks. And so I was like, okay, well, how can I use these sticks in something? I guess I'll do a game that uses sticks. And I did table battles. And it really, I was just doing it just to use up those sticks to get that box out of our back room. And, you know, at the end of the first couple days, we had sold out and I needed to order more sticks.
And so not now for Dynasty.
Yeah. And, you know, I told Richard about, I talked to Richard once on the phone. It was a wonderful conversation. I know Richard was a controversial figure for some folks, but I liked Richard. I liked talking to him. We got along real well. And I told him this about table battles and how, you know, it was kind of his fault the game existed and it's been really popular. And then he said, does that mean I get a cut? Which seemed very appropriate for Richard. So,
yeah. You had told the story of table battles. The fact that it just sort of came out of nowhere, I think, is kind of a neat tale, though, that it was, hey, what do we do with these things? Oh, crap, we've got a hit. You know, it's sort of.
Yeah, I mean, and part of it, too, is that and then Supply Lines, which came out that same year, but a little earlier, were the first games of mine that really got a decent amount of attention from a Wargamer audience. And I wasn't used to it because I had, you know, 15, 20 games out by that point, which all kind of did okay. I was a very middling war game designer. I mean, I did good work, I think, but no one really noticed it. And I wasn't expecting people to notice it. Really, we were expecting Hollenspiel to mostly publish and make money off other designers' games. And then, you know, let me get my stuff out there. And those took off. And since then, my own designs have been very consistent sellers and a big selling point for our stuff. And it's kind of hard to wrap my head around that because I'm used to kind of devaluing my own work. And I'm trying not to get too big ahead about it. You know, like, oh, well, you know, if I release something this year, I know it's going to do well. I know this is going to be a hit. And it makes me a little cocky sometimes because, like, Westfalia, that came out in 2019, that is a 6-player only game. It's for exactly 6 players. And that's hubris, but it worked. So, you know,
you're coming to Origins to lead a Westfalia game one of these years, right?
Oh boy. Maybe.
Look, a game convention is about the only place you're going to get 6 people to sit still for 5 hours to play a game that you have to have 6 people for.
Oh, but this game is less than 2 hours. It's okay. That was a big part of it because, you know, I said, okay, I'm doing a game for exactly 6 players. It can't be long. It's already too much buy-in. It has exactly 6 players. It's about the peace treaty ending the 30 years and 80 years war. So that's nerdy. It's highly asymmetric with these kind of interconnected victory conditions. There's all this stuff that requires a lot of buy-in. So it needs to be short to make it tableable. So I very specifically was like, I have to make this game a 2-hour game. This cannot be Here I Stand. That takes, you know, 6 hours to play. Nothing against Here I Stand at all.
It's going for a whole different effect.
Yeah. But just like I knew as far as the audience we could bring in and the fact that it does not scale, that there needed to be some concession to, you know, what do people get this on the table?
Yeah. My question still stands. When are you coming to Origins to be to be in charge of a table full of Westfalia players?
I don't know. Maybe all next right. year, maybe the year after. But we'll see how things are going with how comfortable I am around people.
Yeah. This would have been the Origins to have that not be a problem because there were only half as many as normal. So, yeah. For folks that don't get the full reference, Origins this year was held in October, and so the combination of both plague and time of year significantly affected attendance. As Gary Mengel has frequently pointed out, do not draw any conclusions whatsoever based on attendance numbers or anything at Origins this year. There were too many confounding factors to try and draw any conclusions. But Gamma did finally release the numbers, and they were just north of 10,000 for the people there. It was 10,000 and some change. 500 and something, 400 and something, depending on which set of numbers you're looking at. So this would have been the year to not have to worry about a lot of people, but I totally get it. One of these days we'll see if we can't drag you back down there to join us and have Mike buy the beer. Cause
there you go.
We'll be Mike about it. Or the bourbon, whatever Mike can smuggle into the exhibit hall there. we promised we were going to keep this to close to an hour. Last questions. What do you got?
Last question. So let's see. Something like Horse and Musket. So let's take that, for example. That's a series that has a definite beginning, a middle, and an end, it sounds like. So are there any plans? And I guess this might be hard to do based on the way you do handle publishing these things and maybe not liking to do Kickstarters. But would there be any plans maybe at some point of maybe revisiting Horse and Musket, maybe doing an expansion or some kind of like random scenario generator expansion for Horse and Musket or just anything that, you know, like maybe a deluxe edition of Horse and Musket or anything like that? Any thoughts on that?
I probably wouldn't do that just because it's just not our style to do that kind of crowdfunding thing. And I think Horse and Musket, so it's sold very well, you know, but it's also a series that sells well within the confines of our model, right? Because I don't know if it has the same draw that, say, a Commands and Colors game has, or because of just how niche the particular battles are and how varied and obscure they can be at times. So I don't know if it was published like in a traditional offset way or as a deluxe edition, if it would, you know, sell as well as it needs to support doing it that way. Does that make sense?
Yeah, no, I think it does. Yeah.
Now, definitely. One thing we have been talking about perhaps doing much further down the road would be like a hardcover scenario book that, you know, would just be the scenarios from the box games, all in one hardcover book, and that might be something that would be a specialty item. And you know, for people who are, you know, into the kind of not collector mindset, but you know, just are really into the series. But I don't think we would, you know, I mean, we've already republished it once as far as redoing all the counters and that. I don't want to do it again.
Thought you were gonna do the giant field crate of, you know, all the collected volumes plus the giant deluxe neoprene mat, and you will hand deliver it by pickup truck to whoever, and it costs like $1,400 for everything in the giant crate.
Now I've already made my custom neoprene mat. I don't need that.
Can you give us some insight or some preview as to what's going to happen with the Hollandaise sale this year, and what might be the Hollandaise special game that you're going to give away in limited release and then end up republishing again 5 years later to howls of protest?
Okay. So this year, as is our usual, the sales in the beginning, it's going to be running November 15th through 28th this year. And every game, every box game is going to be on sale, $5 off. And if you spend so much, you get an additional percentage off. You buy at least two games, then you get the free game. And each year at the Hollandaise sale, we usually have canvas maps. We may or may not have that this year because of material shortages due to the shipping kerfuffle. That hasn't really impacted us very much at all, but it might do it in this way, you know, because we're actually releasing games this fall, which, you know, we're really lucky and really blessed in that regard.
But everybody else is trying to. They're just all stuck on a boat, you know?
Yeah. The end of year game that's releasing with the sale box game is my game Nicaea. It is not a war game. It is a snarky game about the First Council of Nicaea that created the Nicene Creed. So
some of the excerpts you've posted on social media have been quite amusing.
I'm glad you're amused. Other people have been less amused. You know, I got my third death threat for this game. And usually people wait until the game comes out to give me a death threat. They gave me this one like a year ahead of time, so they're really excited for the game. I am too. It's a good game. And the free game that comes out this year, if you buy at least two games, you get the freebie game, is Republic of Virtue, and is a two-player card game. You are each kind of mid-level politicians in revolutionary France trying to keep your heads. And that's pretty much that game. not planning on republishing it. We weren't planning on republishing Reign of Witches or Toledo War, but, you know, did eventually. If we were to republish this one, it would be down the line because you don't have a second game to pack it with. So just buy it from the sale. We have copies. Just buy it from the sale. We'll give it to you. We ordered more than we had sold, quote unquote, last year. So which is what we do every year. And every year it never seems to be enough, which is a good problem to have. I'm not complaining.
Yeah.
Yeah, there seem to be worse problems to have. All right, so I think that that pretty much wraps up our time here with Amabel. I appreciate you taking the time, you know, taking time away from playing your own games there for a bit. but definitely always enjoy having you on because the insights on the company, especially you guys are a bit of a unicorn out there in terms of the game business. There are some others starting to tread the path that you guys have blazed, but it's always neat to hear not just some of the game ideas and designs and insights, but also some of the business insights. And that's a side of the hobby I don't think enough people truly appreciate what it takes to make these things go. And so it's always nice that you're willing to share those things. And so that's great. So thank you. Folks, the Hollandaise sale will be starting very shortly after this episode is live. So go spend money because like we want to help great war game companies stay in business. And strategy game companies, not just war games. You guys sell all kinds of cool stuff. I'm unlikely to ever play one of the train games, but there's enough other games that I'm more than happy to get to the table with you guys. I pulled out my copy of Blitzkrieg the other day and was pushing stuff around without a kid in the room and was still having fun playing with Blitzkrieg. It was great. But yeah, so thank you for being here, Mike. Thank you for taking the time away from the bourbon bottle. Appreciate it.
No, thank you. Amabel, it was a pleasure being on the podcast with you.
Thank you. Yeah.
And I look forward to sending you some more money.
Okay. I look forward to taking it.
And I suspect Mike probably already has like 4 emails written of, hey, I need this artwork for this TTS mod.
No, but I will probably send one because like I said, I do have Horse and Musket. So I mean, if you want to take a look at that, I may send you a link to that or something.
Okay. So. Cool. And audience, thank you for being here. We really appreciate it. We'll catch everybody next time on another episode of Mentioned in Dispatches.